Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Morris Pearl, chair of the group Patriotic Millionaires, who explains why he believes the Republican-controlled House vote to repeal Dodd-Frank banking regulations is courting disaster. Alden Meyer of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who assesses the ability of the newly formed U.S. Climate Alliance to bypass Donald Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement and influence policy outcomes on climate change. And Melissa Mays, a water crisis activist from Flint, Michigan, who discusses the current crisis of Flint's water contamination crisis and recent charges of manslaughter filed against city and state officials. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A week after Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt imposed an embargo on Qatar, the pain in the monarchy's capital, Doha, was growing. Dairy products briefly disappeared from stores before food aid came from Turkey and Iran. The embargo also led to a shortage of U.S. dollars used to pay foreign workers, who make up nearly 90% of Qatar's population. Tensions between Qatar and Saudi Arabia have been building for over 20 years and escalated after Qatar became an economic powerhouse in exporting liquefied natural gas. The hereditary monarchy also pursued an independent foreign policy that included support for the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas while developing friendlier ties with Iran. Saudi Arabia and its Persian Gulf allies are also angry at Qatar for underwriting the Al Jazeera news agency, which gave extensive coverage to dissidents and their grievances during the Arab Spring uprisings in 2011. On Capitol Hill, a coalition of groups funded by Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE are pushing for U.S. sanctions against Qatar in response to its support of Hamas. Sanctions would be imposed to ban exports to Qatar of defense technologies, arms, and loans totaling over $10 million. Al Jazeera reports this reflects growing linkages between hawkish Israeli groups, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. Throughout the Qatar crisis, the Trump administration has issued conflicting and often contradictory policy positions. 50 years after the U.S. Supreme Court legalized interracial marriages in the Loving decision, one in six couples in America is racially mixed. Still, hostility to interracial couples remains an enduring undercurrent in the American psyche. Angela Ross, a white Virginia woman who married a black man in 2008, recalls being warned, "You can be friends with black people, but don't ever marry a black man." In the Loving case, Mildred Loving, a racially mixed black woman, and her white husband, Richard Loving, were arrested in their bedroom in 1958 by Virginia police, months after they were married in Washington, D.C. It took nearly a decade before the Supreme Court overturned Virginia's law against interracial marriage. The unanimous ruling upended laws on mixed-race marriage in 16 other states. Today, according to a recent Pew Research report, only 14% of those who are not black say they would object if a close relative married a black person. A quarter of newly married Asian and Latino spouses have a partner of a different race or ethnicity. The number of interracial marriages that include a black partner has tripled since 1980. However, there is a stark political split in how Americans feel about interracial marriage. About half of Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents say that growing numbers of people marrying others of different races is good for society, compared to only about a quarter of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents. 1 year after the massacre at the gay Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, black and Latino survivors and their loved ones are struggling to recover in the face of the stigma of being part of the LGBTQ community of color. The attack at the Pulse nightclub was the deadliest mass shooting in American history, and the massacre created new divisions in Orlando. Many black and Latinos who frequented the Pulse club were outed with the news coverage and then faced hostility in their own communities. Pulse was a place where a diverse spectrum of people could feel comfortable, according to the Miami Herald. However, the black community feels it has been sidelined in the narrative of the attack and its fallout. Unmarried LGBTQ couples with families have trouble accessing benefits in a system that wasn't built for their partnerships. Overall, city government was ill-equipped to handle this tragedy in the LGBTQ community of color. Cha-Cha Davis, a former club promoter at Pulse, who now serves as an advocate for Orlando's minority gay residents, says many in the LGBTQ Black community feel like double minorities, excluded from their racial community for their sexual orientation and from the larger LGBTQ community because of their race. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The Republican-controlled House of Representatives passed the so-called Financial Choice Act on June 8th that would gut the 2010 Dodd-Frank banking regulation law by a party-line vote of 233 to 186. The overall objective of the GOP bill is to eliminate much of the oversight of the nation's banks that was imposed after the 2008 financial meltdown, the worst economic crisis in the U.S. since the Great Depression. Despite Trump administration and Republican Party claims that the Dodd-Frank regulations have hobbled U.S. banks, Wall Street and banks large and small across the nation have been healthy and profitable since the passage of Dodd-Frank. If approved by the U.S. Senate, the legislation would remove rules to prevent risky investment strategies that could trigger another banking crisis, weaken protections for mortgage borrowers and military veterans, and restrict predatory lenders. The bill would also erode the enforcement power of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, established in 2011. Your reporter spoke with Morris Pearl, chair of the group Patriotic Millionaires, who's a former managing director of BlackRock Incorporated, one of the largest investment firms in the world. Here, Pearl explains why he believes the GOP vote to severely weaken the Dodd-Frank banking regulations law is courting disaster.
We had a huge financial crisis starting in 2008, the year before Obama took over as president. That was caused in part by a lot of things, but in part by really reckless behavior of some of the bank executives. Now, the Republican Congress is trying to convince America it was actually caused by the Dodd-Frank Act, was signed in July of 2010, that somehow that's the reason why small businesses had trouble getting bank loans back in that time, even though it was about 2 years later that the Dodd-Frank Act was signed. So we think it's just ridiculous. They want to kind of turn back the clock. We go through cycles of sort of the banks having lots of power and the government regulators getting more power. And now the Congress, the Republican-controlled Congress, really wants to turn the clock back and says the government regulators, the representatives, the people have too much power, and we need to give more power to the banks and the bank executives who run those banks. And I just think that's wrong. You know, we were not in the right place before that was passed in 2000, you know, prior to 2010. We had a huge crisis. And we brought in some new laws and rules and regulations to prevent another crisis like that, to prevent some of the problems. And now the Republican Congress says, no, that was a bad idea, and they want to undo all of that. And that's just wrong. It's wrong for America. It's wrong for small businesses. It's wrong for investors. And in particular, it's even wrong for most banks. It's not going to help the banks to turn that back. The United States and New York, where I live, is the financial capital of the world because of our strong regulatory infrastructure, because our government regulators give people all over the world confidence to send their money to invest in America. And if we want to be less regulated, well, there's lots of countries with less regulation. You could send your money to lots of countries if you want an unregulated financial system. That's not the way it's going to succeed for America.
Morris, just a final question here.
Sure.
If the Senate does pass some of these key House provisions in this legislation and critical parts of the Dodd-Frank bill are removed or eroded, what is the jeopardy the nation faces overall? Are we going to see a return to credit default swaps and derivatives that were abused by so many on Wall Street that in part triggered the financial crisis we saw
hit the country and the world in 2008?
I don't know if we're going to see the exact same problem again. Probably not. The people who, you know, there are still people that remember 2008. It's been only 9 years. What we'll see is the executives who run the banks going back to the attitude that, well, if I make a lot of money, if I do something really risky, it might win, it might lose. Like if you bet on black in a roulette table, it might win, you might lose. Well, if I win, I'll make a huge amount of money and be able to retire and support my family for the rest of my life without having to work anymore. And if I lose, well, I'll lose my job and I'll get another job. And the taxpayers will, you know, be stuck with it. That's where we're going back to. And I don't think that's good. I think that's wrong. It has this huge agency problem because the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is part of the government, guarantees the deposits of the depositors. And if the banks are allowed to take more risk, well, that really means that the government is sort of guaranteeing your deposits. You don't worry about what the bank does when you make a deposit in your checking account. You don't do research on how the bank invests the money or how they make loans, stuff like that. You don't need to because we have an FDIC, which guarantees your deposits. And so there's no invisible hand of the marketplace saying, oh, people won't deposit money in risky banks. Well, they will if the risky bank offers slightly higher interest rates. And so it's a, well, heads I win, tails somebody else loses for the actual people that work in the bank. And that's not good. We will have another crisis. It won't be the exact same thing again. It'll be a different kind of crisis. But we will have another crisis eventually. Yes.
That was Morris Pearl, chair of the group Patriotic Millionaires and former managing director of BlackRock Incorporated, one of the largest investment firms in the world. Find links to more commentary and analysis of the GOP House vote to weaken Dodd-Frank banking regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Donald Trump's June 1st announcement that his administration is withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord has prompted more coverage in the corporate media of the climate crisis than that of several preceding years. Because the Paris Agreement stipulates that any signatory nation must wait 3 years before finalizing its withdrawal, the first day the U.S. can officially withdraw is November 5, 2020, 1 day after the next U.S. presidential election. However, Trump announced that his administration would do nothing to fulfill previous climate pledges made by President Obama, so it's not clear how much difference it makes whether the U.S. is officially inside or outside of the voluntary pact, to which all but two nations in the world agreed. But a move the same day as Trump's announcement could offset the effect of policy changes at the federal level to reduce climate pollution. On June 1st, the governors of California, New York, and Washington State announced the formation of the U.S. Climate Alliance, pledging to uphold the objectives of the Paris Agreement by reducing carbon emissions 26-28% compared with 2005 levels by the year 2025. Within a few days, the bipartisan group attracted 9 other states and Puerto Rico to join. Later, 10 other U.S. governors, the mayor of Washington, D.C., and hundreds of other mayors of U.S. cities declared they would work toward the same goals without officially joining the alliance. Together, the members and supporters of the alliance comprise 57% of the U.S. population and contribute 40% of the country's greenhouse gas emissions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alden Meyer, Director of Strategy and Policy with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who's worked on climate issues for decades. Here he explains how the Climate Alliance can exert influence on local and national policy outcomes on climate change.
The U.S. Climate Alliance, which is a state mechanism, along with more than 1,200 mayors, businesses, investors, and college and university presidents, have announced that they are still in the Paris Agreement, and they will do their utmost to meet the U.S. commitments under Paris. This is a remarkable development. It's obviously greatly welcomed by countries around the world. Just yesterday, the Prime Minister of Fiji, who is the incoming president of the Conference of the Parties to the Framework Agreement, named Governor Jerry Brown of California as his special envoy for state and regional action. And Governor Brown, along with Governor Inslee of Washington State and Governor Kate Brown of Oregon, announced they would all be going to the next climate summit meeting in Bonn, Germany in November. Mayor Bloomberg has been very actively working with representatives of cities and mayors across the country on this issue. And so there's no doubt that there has been a sharp reaction to President Trump's announcement of withdrawing the U.S. from Paris. And these mayors and governors and business leaders and others are trying to make clear that President Trump does not speak for America on this issue, and that there is tremendous support for the Paris Agreement, for climate action, for the clean energy revolution, and all the jobs and economic prosperity that can bring. And they will be taking this message of we are still in to the rest of the world.
Given the federal government's role in this issue, will that make it harder or maybe even impossible for states and cities to take steps to address the climate crisis?
Well, there's two issues here. One is, can the federal government get in the way of state action or local action to reduce emissions? In certain areas, it can. For example, California has the right under the Clean Air Act to set stronger standards for vehicle emissions than the federal government. They have a waiver from the Environmental Protection Agency to exercise that authority. This is one of the concerns California has, is that the Trump administration may try to withdraw that waiver, and that would lead to a court fight over that. The other issue is who represents the United States at these negotiations. Clearly, the states and the cities and the business leaders do not formally represent the United States of America in the negotiations. They can't take positions on behalf of the U.S. or negotiate with other countries, but they can send a very important political signal that major elements of U.S. society remain committed to Paris. They will be doing their best to make sure we meet the emissions reduction commitments that we agreed to under the agreement, and that President Trump and his administration represent a short-term aberration in U.S. climate policy, not a long-term trend, and that after he leaves office, hopefully the next president will return to the table in the negotiations and the U.S. will be back in formally as a country.
Alden Meyer, considering the governmental entities that are either holding back or pushing forward the transition to a clean energy economy, overall, are you optimistic or not about the big picture?
Well, this is a trend that's been building steam over many years now, and we expect to see more cities and businesses and states join this loose coalition because these officials recognize that climate change is already having impacts on their communities, on their budgets, on their infrastructure. And unless we address the climate crisis, those impacts are only going to get worse. They also understand that the clean energy economy, which is one of the main solutions to climate change, offers tremendous economic development and employment benefits to those who show leadership, which is one of the reasons you've seen both Democratic and Republican governors and legislatures over the last decade or so adopt renewable standards for their utilities, requiring a larger share of electricity generation to come from renewable sources. And these standards are very popular, including in Republican states, because they bring economic, employment, and tax benefits to local communities. So this is a trend we've seen building for a while. I think what President Trump did with his announcement of withdrawal from Paris is galvanize it to come together in a more public and unified way to present a united front saying that the U.S. is still in as a country, as a society, no matter what the current president says. So that's welcome. But this trend will continue, it will build, and I think it'll be clear to the rest of the world that the United States as a whole is still very committed to climate action, even if our president isn't.
That was Alden Meyer, Director of Strategy and Policy with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Learn more about the U.S. Climate Alliance by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan, continues, with thousands of residents still forced to use bottled water for drinking, cooking, and cleaning. Flint's crisis began in 2014 when an unelected city manager appointed by the governor attempted to save money by changing the town's water source from Lake Huron to the Flint River, triggering lead contamination that endangered the health of the entire population, particularly children. Now, after years of frustration, uncertainty, and protest, the city's residents were surprised and pleased to hear that Michigan's Attorney General, Bill Shute, had charged five city and state officials with involuntary manslaughter for a death resulting from the Flint water crisis. The officials charged, including the state's Health and Human Services Director, Nick Lyon, face allegations of failing to notify and lack of action to stop the outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, allowing the outbreak to continue spreading through Flint's water system. At least 12 residents of Flint died of Legionnaire's disease, with 90 others sickened in two waves of the outbreak in 2015. Despite the allegations of criminal wrongdoing brought against these state officials, Michigan's Republican Governor Rick Snyder has expressed his full support for them and has kept them in their jobs. Your reporter spoke with Melissa Mays, a water crisis activist and founder of the Flint-based group, What Are You Fighting For? Here she discusses the current status of Flint's water contamination crisis and the recent charges filed against city and state officials.
Well, January of 2015, we received a letter at our house that said for the previous 9 months, our water had been contaminated with a cancer-causing byproduct. And we realized that all of the false, you know, it's going to be okay, all the statements that the state and city had made were untrue. And so my husband and I came up with What Are You Fighting For? To be a portal of accurate information. And so we started testing the water and researching to find out what we were being exposed to and who was doing this to us. And along the way, we discovered lead, bacteria, people were dying. And so we've worked with legislature. We've worked to change the laws, not just in Michigan, but in the entire country, because this isn't just happening to Flint. But unfortunately, today is day 1,150 since we have had clean and safe water. So we've been fighting for health care for Flint residents, to have all of the damaged pipes replaced in our homes, in the streets, and the service lines, and to for the people to be held accountable who did this to us, because these were choices that were made.
Well, accountability is certainly in the news this past week. Five Michigan state officials, including some who report directly to Michigan Governor Mitch Snyder, have recently been charged with involuntary manslaughter in connection to an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease that's linked with the Flint water crisis. That outbreak of Legionnaire's killed a dozen people in Flint during the contamination crisis. Maybe you could discuss, Melissa, tell our listeners a bit about the context for understanding these charges that have been leveled against these officials by Michigan's state attorney general.
Well, typically for a year, there's 78 cases or 78 deaths from Legionnaires in the entire country. We had 12 in just a year and a half period. The unfortunate part is these people knew about it, that we had people in the health department, we had people working for the county and the state, that their one job was to protect the public health and to let us know if things changed, like an outbreak of a bacteria, something that people could protect themselves from, because you basically inhale the bacteria and the droplets and the steam in the water, so through the showers. So when these cases, and it was like 100 cases and 12 deaths, came up, they went out of their way to actually hide it. And because of this, the doctors didn't know, and we have another 177 deaths from bacterial pneumonia, which is what Legionnaires is, that have gone misdiagnosed, basically, because the doctors, my son had pneumonia in September of 2014, and he was 10, and that was odd for someone to get pneumonia at that point in time. But my doctor, the pediatrician, didn't know to look for Legionnaires, so he didn't, because no one alerted the doctors that there was this huge outbreak. They actually went out of their way to cover it all up, and because of that, people died. So we were fortunate with my son that he was put on the right antibiotic, but other people were not so lucky. So we're looking at about close to 200 people that don't have answers, and there's no way to find justice for them because they lost their loved ones.
Melissa, as you look at these charges being leveled at the state officials, is this too little too late, or are you satisfied that the
wheels of justice, although they're slow, are finally starting to move in the right direction?
It's a good start. It's not good enough, but there has to be punishment that for these people that completely did not do their job, they did the opposite. And it needs to go up higher because at the end of the day, these direct recruits reported to the governor. And his whole thing was running the state of Michigan as a business instead of, you know, a government. And we see that on a national level now. And the scary part about it is that profit was put over people the entire time. In these emails going back and forth, they were more worried about backlash and how much this was going to cost and what this was going to do rather than saving these people's lives. Because again, even though we're seeing these charges, no one is in jail. And we want them to live in Flint. We want them to shower in the burning, blistering showers that we have to deal with and worrying, you know, is this shower going to make me sick? Is this water going to hurt my kids? Do these filters work? I mean, there's too many unanswered questions. Because again, at the end of the day, we still can't use our water and there's no end in sight for that.
Melissa, I've read some opinion in Flint that residents there are really pushing for an indictment of Governor Snyder himself for his role in this crisis. What's your view of Governor Snyder and what should be the next step in terms of legal cases being developed around the Flint water crisis?
Oh, I absolutely agree, because Governor Snyder decided to take away the democratic responsibilities and rights of the Flint residents and our elected officials locally and have the state be the complete dictatorship is basically what the emergency manager law is. To settle a bottom line, he put one person in that was unappointed or that he appointed and that was unelected that answered only to him. And so there was no way that he could say that he didn't know what was going on. So, well, when you set up an emergency manager dictatorship structure and you put yourself in complete charge of it, you have to be completely prepared to deal with the consequences, and you need to be held accountable. And that's where he sits right now. He needs to be held accountable.
That was water crisis activist Melissa Mays, founder of the Flint-based group, What Are You Fighting For? Find links to local and national groups working to ensure the public's access to safe, affordable water by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, WRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.